All right. Well, Senator Murkowski, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be back. To be back.
And Scott, do you want to go ahead and kick us off?
Well, thanks for taking some time to meet with us. Always good to see you. And
I missed August. I usually am here around Blueberry Festival time, and we were still in session. So sorry about that, but good to be back.
Good. And since then, you've actually been traveling quite a bit, it seems. And I'm checking to see what's the main thing you're hearing from folks, and what are the main things that you can address going forward in the Senate?
So a couple things. First, you're right. I have been traveling a lot in the past week alone. I've been from Kotzebue to Kodiak to Unalaska, down here in Ketchikan, up in the Palmer, Mat-Su area. It's been a lot of travel in different parts of the state. I can tell you that people are sharing with me the concerns about inflation, what that means. When you're up in Kotzebue, they're about $8.50 a gallon. Out in Noatak and some of the other outlying communities, it's $13-$14 a gallon. And that's the price that they're going to be paying for the rest of the season, because the second fuel barge of the year has come and gone. On Alaska, much the same in terms of their prices and what that means. It's $1,000 from Unalaska to Anchorage one way. What does that mean if you're a family? Here in Ketchikan, people are talking about just the cost of moving around, the cost of goods. That's a real high priority. Another issue around the state is housing. Housing. And affordable housing. Where is it? How can we get it? It's impacting our ability to attract teachers, law enforcement, healthcare professionals. So housing is an issue. Also, childcare is an issue that is coming about more and more and more. We're hearing about workforce shortage everywhere. What that might mean from a small business who's in a restaurant not able to have full shifts or to offer services for a couple of days out of the week. What it means for child care providers, if you can't get folks in, well, then if you don't have the child care, then I can't come to work. It's just this cyclical. So these are kind of some of the real nuts and bolts. Alaskans, in my conversations, are really focused on what is happening here at home. For our fishing and our coastal communities, we're talking about how the season was, because that's part of our economy. We're talking about a lot of the transportation and infrastructure things that are coming our way as a result of the infrastructure bill, some of the broadband water and wastewater initiatives. We've been working to move forward on some of the congressionally directed spending. Ketchikan is going to see the benefit of some of that, whether it's for the water treatment plant or for more funding for broadband, for the airport out here. So it's real local stuff.
And I think it's fair to say that you've been vocally pro-resource development throughout your career in the Senate. And I'm curious if, what you might do in another term to make sure that Alaska has a significant role in providing the materials that are necessary for a transition to more green energy.
Yeah. Well, It's a great question, because once again, Alaska can be in the driver's seat when we think about our more traditional energy resources, oil, gas, coal. Alaska has certainly been a state that has those resources. We've led on oil, absolutely, but we also can play a very key role when it comes to these critical minerals that will be required for this transition for renewable energy resources, whether it is wind turbines, solar panels, what we may be able to do to electrify our transportation fleet. It doesn't come without minerals. And right now, we're not harvesting the minerals as a country that we need in order to have any level of security. And that's a challenge for us. It's not unlike the same challenge that we faced a few decades ago when it came to our reliance on foreign countries for oil. We changed that so that we weren't so reliant on Venezuela or Saudi Arabia. We've gone back to that with this Biden administration, which hasn't been helpful for us. But my point is that we can see this coming when it comes to critical minerals. So once again, we've got the resources here. We need the political will to be able to access them. We know that we have higher environmental standards in this country than most elsewhere. So if we're going to harvest it, if we're going to access these minerals, we got to do it with strong environmental standards. We know that we have human rights practices that are the gold standard. We're not Congo, where we're hauling out cobalt on the backs of children or slave labor. So we need the resources in order to make the transition, but we need to be doing it here in this country. And Alaska has the resources to do it. Had a super great critical minerals summit up in Fairbanks last week. And I was able to help kick that off with Senator Sullivan and just kind of start the very, very important conversation. We've made steps legislatively to address it through legislation that I introduced and got passed into law, the American Minerals Security Act. We funded that then through the infrastructure bill that was put into law last year. So we've made some good progress, but we need to do more.
All right, Scott, did you want to ask something?
Thank you. You mentioned housing. And looking at this complex issue, are there things that can be done or that is being considered on the federal level to help alleviate some of the concerns that you've been hearing across the state?
It's a harder one. It's a harder one for us to try to address from the federal level. And we've been looking at, you know, what is it that we need to be doing from some of the existing programmatic funds. One of the things that I'm doing as the vice chairman of the Indian Affairs Committee, we need to get NAHASDA reauthorized. That's the Native American Housing Development Act. That needs to be reauthorized. That could be significant in terms of resources that go to help so many in our Native American, Alaska Indian communities. One of the things that we are doing that is helping to make a difference, and people might not stop to think about it, but with a house, in order to really have a functioning home here, you have to have the utilities to it as well. And so this is something that we have aggressively pursued through the infrastructure bill that we enacted into law. As one of the architects of that bill and one who negotiated through the process, it was really important to make sure that we put resources not only towards aging infrastructure, but to those areas where we had no infrastructure at all. In this state, we still have far too many communities that are not underserved communities. They are unserved communities. And so what we're doing to really bring about a level of equity there on the water and wastewater side, I think, is an important part of this equation as well. And then to your point, Eric, when we talk about energy, I think we also recognize that it makes sense to do everything that we can to make sure that our homes are energy efficient so that they don't cost us money. So we've made some good headway with that, with the Energy Act of 2020. Again, energy infrastructure and efficiency in the infrastructure bill. In this latest round, this legislation that was passed on a bipartisan basis, I didn't support it. This was the Inflation Reduction Act, which in my view is a misnomer because I don't think it's going to reduce your inflation. But one of the provisions in that is greater support for efficiency as well, which there are good things in the measure, but on the whole, it was something that I couldn't support. But I think efficiency is also an important part of what we're doing on housing.
Thank you. I'm interested to get your thoughts on the search of Mar-a-Lago, and I'm curious, you know, whether you think that if it turns out just to be that Donald Trump mishandled classified documents, do you think that's a high enough bar to justify prosecuting a former president?
I think we don't know yet, and I think this is where I think we really need to ensure that there is a level of review of process that is fair, and absolutely to the fullest extent free from that political taint or that political bias. I think most Americans have been watching this, and even before they saw boxes moving out, they had kind of made up in their own mind, you know, whether this was an egregious act by Department of Justice designed to just bring down Donald Trump, or whether it was, aha, you know, finally got caught type of a thing. We need to make sure that the highest level of integrity is pursued throughout all of this. And I'm not sure yet that we have enough information to really determine whether that is the case.
That's fair enough. Scott?
Moving to another high-profile subject, you've been very visible in the selection of Supreme Court justices, and now we've come to the Roe v. Wade decision, mm-hmm. with the Dobbs. And now you've introduced some bipartisan legislation to codify some of the Roe v. Wade. And I was curious your thoughts on the inertia that legislation might have and the things that have transpired to this point.
Yeah. Well, I was determined to be part of a bipartisan approach to address the court decision in Dobbs. As you look to that opinion that was handed down, it pretty much laid out to the Congress that if you're going to address this, it needs to be legislated. And so the only way that you're going to get legislation like this passed is if it's bipartisan. It's just apparent. The Democrats tried to advance what they viewed as a potential response. This was even before Dobbs came down, and it was in my view far in excess of codifying Roe versus Wade, and it was not. It was not a solution that I felt reflected the vast views of most people in this country. I think if you look at polling, it is clear that in this country, most Americans would say that they accept a woman's right to choose, but recognize that is not without limitation. And so, what are those limitations? What might an undue burden constitute? And so that's what the four of us, two Republicans, two Democrats, attempted to do with our bipartisan legislation that we've introduced that would codify Roe, but also it would go further to codify the protections for contraception. That was not at issue in Dobbs, but if you look to Clarence Thomas's comments, he alluded that those types of protections could also be at risk. Just as I don't think women in this country or people in this country want to roll back 50 years of women's reproductive health rights, I don't think they want to roll back 50 years of what has become accepted, what has become relied on when it comes to access to contraception. So we codify Griswold and the associated cases that that incorporate those protections for contraception. So you ask about the inertia, and that's fair. Right now, I might suggest to you that there's probably a little bit of politics that is going on. I think you see Democrats that are saying, we're the ones that want to support women and Republicans don't. And Republicans are looking at the Women's Health Protection Act and saying Democrats want to allow for unlimited abortion at any time with no exceptions whatsoever. And the truth is that it's somewhere in the middle there, as it usually is. But I don't think that right now we will see resolve on this. Probably until we get on the other side of these campaigns in this mid-election cycle. I think that's unfortunate, because as I'm talking to women around the state, they're very, very unnerved by what they have seen as a consequence of the Dobbs decision. They don't know what happens next, but they're anxious. And I would like to give some certainty and some finality. And that's why I'm working on a bipartisan effort to do just that.
Thank you. And sticking with that for just a moment, you said when the leaked draft opinion came out that it rocked your confidence with the court and that it was unexpected based on your conversations with the nominees. Mm-hmm. And just sort of, this is a two-part question. I'm curious whether that experience changes how you evaluate future court nominees and what you think should be done to restore your confidence and public confidence in the court.
Well, I made that statement, and it really did. I think the word I used was rattle my confidence. And it was based on the conversations that I had had directly with these justices as we'd gone through the process, where I have an opportunity in the quiet of my office to ask as many questions as I possibly can. And you can't ask a nominee, will you overturn X case? If they were to answer directly, they would be disqualified from the get-go. They wouldn't do that, and so I know not to ask that. But what you do ask is, share with me what you believe precedent is. What is settled law? What is reliance? At what point in time is it reasonable to assume that as a society we have reliance? So these are the types of questions. And I really felt like I should be able to rely on their truthful answers to me. Now, they weren't under oath. Maybe that's what I need. I'm not suggesting that because I can't put them under oath in my office, but it has caused me to look at our process as how we confirm Supreme Court nominees for lifetime appointments. If these hearings that the public is welcome to observe and certainly do, if the hearings have become nothing more than just either a little bit of showboating that goes on, or really answers that are so nuanced that they don't really give any foreshadowing of the individual and their perspective, if they really don't have much meaning anymore, how are we to allow for a process for confirmation of this very select group of individuals that are in this extraordinary position of power? And so you ask a fair question, and I don't yet have the specific answer. There's some who've said, well, we just need to expand the court. Well, if the process for putting these individuals on the bench is still the same, then that doesn't tell me how that really changes the equation here. So I don't think that's your answer. Some have suggested maybe it's not a lifetime appointment. That would be an interesting conversation. There is no judicial code of ethics that the Supreme Court has, as other bars have. Some have suggested that we need to look at that. I think, quite honestly, I think that that's something that the courts need to do internally. But these are important. We need to be able to believe in the integrity of our courts. It's too critical to the foundational principles of our, three separate but equal branches of government. We have to believe in the credibility and the integrity of the courts. And I think right now there is a view that the courts have become just as political as the executive and the congressional branch.
All right. Well, Senator Murkowski, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Good to be back with you guys.
Thank you.